From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
It seems like, well, we live here and it should be as it is in the United States. Well, the law in the United States doesn't apply here.
Sometimes we want things to be a certain way, or we want what our neighbor has.
What they may not understand is that the Cubans were able to acquire that immigration status because they don't have a fatherland.
Today, turf wars. What happens when we try to share spaces, compete to see who's best, or when we simply can't live in the places we want to? All this coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No te vayas. Hey, if you enjoy Latino USA, I bet you will love NPR's Planet Money. It's full of funny, insightful stories about how the world works, like how Price Club and its imitators made shopping harder and why customers actually loved it. Plus, useful stuff like the inside story behind the resurrection of the Hydrox cookie. Find Planet Money now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. For lots of Americans, retiring seems like it's becoming increasingly out of reach, if it's even possible at all. The age of retirement has slowly been climbing over the last few decades, and economic realities mean younger generations are having a harder time supporting their aging parents, and Social Security checks aren't often enough to live on. But for more and more Americans interested in the good life, retiring to Latin America has become an affordable solution.
Cotacachi, Cotacachi, Quiroga, Cotacachi.
Like, for instance, a town in Ecuador called Cotacachi. Cotacachi is a mountain town of about 40,000 people, not far from Ecuador's capital city of Quito. But if you go to Cotacachi, you'll see signs in both English and in Spanish, signs that say houses for sale, 10,000 square foot lots, and country-style homes. These are new signs, of course, in a mostly old colonial town. About half of Cotacachi's population is mestizo, a mix of indigenous and European descent. They mostly live in the center of town. The other half of town is indigenous Quichua, who live in several dozen villages on the outskirts of town. The Quichua have their own internal laws, their own culture, and their own unique set of traditions. Traditions like the minga, a communal workday when a whole village gets together to do an important job. On one particular day, village men are meeting to fix some water pipes. That's Rumiñahui Anrango, speaking in Quichua. He says the minga has been part of his people's lives for many years. Everyone lends a hand to accomplish necessary tasks for the good of the community. But just a short walk away, a growing number of mostly American retirees are creating their own community in Cotacachi with their own traditions, like buying yarn at the Sunday market.
Regular or pequeño?
Regular.
Okay.
Yes. Or taking Spanish lessons at the coffee shop.
¿Cuánto cuesta? ¿Cuánto? No cuánto. ¿Cuánto?
But I was a girl last.
Or joining the Thursday night poker game at what's considered the local gringo bar.
Retired guys. Just retired. It's beautiful down here.
Yeah, absolute paradise.
But is there enough room in paradise for everyone? On today's show, we're talking about this idea. Groups of people taking up the same space, vying for the same turf, and clashing when those groups don't seem to agree on who should have what. In Ecuador now, there's an ongoing debate about Cotacachi's future, now that so many wealthy retirees have started buying property. Reporter Dusty Christensen takes the story from here.
Many people would call these retirees expats. But here in Ecuador,
They're also immigrants, because they've moved here with the intention of staying. It's all part of a larger trend of north-to-south migration. As baby boomers in the U.S. hit old age, more and more are deciding to move to Latin America. That's partly because of this magazine.
International Living.
That's Wendy DeChambeau, a Cotacachi expat and a local correspondent for the magazine.
It does focus on the positive because for most of us, living abroad, living in another country is a positive experience.
There's the adventure, the opportunity to get to know a different culture, and of course the perfect weather. But something else draws people to retire in Ecuador, and in Latin America in general.
People can live here on their pensions or their social security, which is becoming harder and harder to do back in the U.S.
For locals in Cotacachi, however, the experience hasn't always been so pleasant. Alberto Andrango's long braid is gray now, his receding hairline hidden under a traditional felt top hat. In the 1970s, Alberto helped found a powerful local indigenous union at a time when some restaurants in the capital city, Quito, would deny him service just for being Quichua. Alberto was also mayor of Cotacachi from 2009 to 2014.
And it was then that I realized the problems that the foreigners are causing here in Cotacachi.
He gives me a list of grievances.
For example, a foreigner went to complain that his indigenous neighbor had a rooster that was crowing every day at 5 in the morning.
Well,
that's not going to do. We can't go to a neighbor and say, look, go kill your rooster so the foreigner can sleep. So now we have a culture clash.
But most of all, Alberto says, there were worries about gentrification.
Economically, all of Cotacachi has been affected, not just the indigenous people, but the whites and mestizos downtown, too. Because the foreigners arrived and bought land at very high prices.
Alberto says that's made buying land too expensive for many locals. Prices for a house in Cotacachi often exceed $100,000. The average monthly income in Ecuador is less than
$900.
A foreigner from the outside world lives in a beautiful house, and the indigenous people, who have lived here for hundreds of years, are living in poverty.
We take a drive over hand-built cobblestone roads to see what he means. The village of El Batán is home to around 90 indigenous families, as well as a large number of retirees living in several gated communities. Pulling up outside of a large security gate, Alberto points out the contrast.
We have, for example, the small community of Tomauku, which shows the great poverty of the area. And here on the right is Jahuapacha, which is the opulence of the foreigners.
The luxury townhouses of the retirees stand in sharp contrast to the cinder block houses of the locals, some of which have dirt floors.
¿Está Don Francisco?
Sí.
Favor.
In one of those cinder block houses lives village president Francisco Guitarra.
La comunidad se creció desde como huasipunguero, ¿no?
He says the village grew out of 20 families sharecropping on a large farm. They first fought to gain title to their land, then organized and worked for decades to get water, electricity, roads, and schools. Once that happened, he says, the local large landowner decided to sell several lots now that they had modern amenities. Locals had the right to buy the lands themselves, but they couldn't afford to. So the owner sold it to an Ecuadorian who'd made his money in the U.S., and he started building houses for retired foreigners. The construction of those houses, the massive trucks hauling materials back and forth, damaged the road the community fought so hard for.
The gringos don't say, look, here's some money, I'll help you, let's fix the road. They don't say anything.
Since then, there have been tense confrontations between Francisco's village and a gated community called Colonia El Batán, mainly over the placement of walls and roads. There have also been break-ins at the Colonia, further eroding trust. Mia Venster, a chain-smoking Belgian woman, has seen some of these confrontations firsthand. She says the irony of calling her neighborhood Colonia El Batán, El Batán Colony, reminds her of her own country's sordid colonial past.
I can associate with the indigenous. It's almost like we are a colonizing power. Just the 14 houses in this community, you know, taking over their land and not giving much back in return.
Many of her neighbors, she says, simply whisk back and forth from Cotacachi in taxis and rarely interact with the village.
I don't think there is a real need for my neighbors, per se, to understand the indigenous way of life.
Still, not all of these newcomers have sour relations with their neighbors.
Hi, you must be Cindy.
Yes, you're
I'm Dusty. So nice to meet you.
Tim and Cindy Jared are a retired couple from Kansas.
See if I can find it. Okay.
Cindy shows me pictures from their first year here.
There it is.
Like some other Americans that live in Cotacachi, Cindy and Tim have befriended their neighbors and feel at home with them. Their neighborhood takes part in Indigenous work days, and Cindy and Tim raise money for the village school.
This was the very first meeting that we had with our community. And this was at the community house with them.
They run soup kitchens, raise scholarship money for local students, teach English, and even help Cotacachi's stray dog population. But all that can't blunt the impact of rising prices for locals. Now, the locals have started to push back. The vast majority of indigenous communities in the area have passed laws that require their local governments to approve the sale of any village land. Many officials say they're not going to approve any new projects, especially if foreigners or outsiders are involved. But the retirees aren't going anywhere. For the foreseeable future, American retirees and Ecuadorians will continue to rub shoulders here. Here at the local expat bar, the retiree rock band Three Shades of Grey is playing its popular monthly gig. Quite a few people on the patio are taking this song's advice to heart.
Yeah, I'm here for the next great earthquake, too. It could come any day.
I'm here until the indigenous say, get out!
Meanwhile, Cotacachi traditions will continue as well. Here, Quechua people are celebrating Inti Raymi, the indigenous sun festival. In the evenings, groups go house to house in their villages, stomping, yelling, and whistling in a circle around a group of musicians. People give the dancers and musicians something to eat or drink, and the party goes on all night long. Then, for 4 days at the end of the festival, they all stomp down together to Cotacachi's central plaza, which they take over completely, dancing three circles around the entire square. Sitting at his kitchen table, Rumiñahui Anrango, Alberto's son, talks about the significance of the festival.
El mestizo que se apropió de un lugar sagrado, en este caso el parque central de...
Rumiñahui explains that back before colonial times, there were places here that were sacred for the indigenous people. The Spaniards took control of those places and built their seats of power there, the church and government buildings. So when the Quechua people take over Cotacachi's park, he says, they're simply reclaiming that space that was taken from them. As if to say, look, we're still here.
Thanks to Dusty Christensen for that story. And, you know, I'd heard a little about Americans moving south for retirement, but I didn't realize they were moving to Ecuador, and I didn't realize how it was actually impacting the people there. And we've got more turf wars coming up.
But I don't think it's an aggressive competition. It's like two moms from different teams. They are friends. Their kids are playing. And each mom is yelling for her team.
We find out who exactly is competing. But first, growing tension between different Latino communities. No te vayas, stay with us.
Voy caminando por el lado soleado de la calle, no me aparto de mi rumbo, mirando los detalles, y encontrarme de ese lado es algo que no me asombra, porque mi madre me decía, nene, anda por la sombra. Camino sin apuro y el sol está caliente, no me importa que me griten ni me llamen los de enfrente, que me observan y me hacen así con el dedo, y yo doy vuelta a la cabeza y me hago el que no los veo. Pero no me molesta ese proceder. quiero que descubran que ando meditabundo. Me pongo mis lentes negros y me meto en mi mundo. Elijo una canción y la pongo a
I am so glad that you're listening to Latino USA as a podcast, and I really want to thank you for doing that. And I bet you're really loving this episode on Turf Wars. I was just wondering if I could ask you a favor. Would you just rate and review our show on iTunes? It means a lot to us and makes a big difference. And if you really love us a lot, how about going to Latino USA and clicking on the donate button? Every contribution, no matter how small, really makes a big difference. Muchas gracias. Thanks for listening. I really appreciate it.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl, with flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide. More at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. And the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness and efforts to strengthen the ability of families and individuals to bounce back from crisis and stay housed. More at melvilletrust.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And I'm sure you know that in Miami, Cuban culture has dominated there for decades, ever since Cubans started fleeing the Castro regime in the early 1960s. Today, Cuban Americans are the area's largest Latino group, and they have lots of political representation. But many other Latin Americans have emigrated there in recent years, and that's led to tension between the established Cuban community and the newcomers, who don't have the same advantages. To explain more, I'm joined by Maria Muriel from WLRN in Miami. Maria is a local reporter there and joins me now on Latino USA. Hey, Maria.
Hey, Maria.
We're going to talk about, I don't know if I want to say exactly dirty laundry, but it's not something that we proudly talk about, which is essentially the divisions and the tensions among different Latino groups.
Right. We are not all one.
And by the way, where are you from, Maria?
I'm from Peru. I was born there and I lived there until I was 11. And then I've been living in Miami ever since.
Lay out for people who don't kind of know a lot about Miami and the different groups. So when did they arrive? Who are they? And how have they settled into Miami?
We call it, journalists down there, we call it the capital of Latin America because we have groups from all over the region. And Central American and Mexican migrants, there are large communities of people from Central America all over South Florida. And actually, last year, we had a large wave of immigrants from Central America, particularly Honduras, who were crossing the border and ending up in South Florida.
Take me a little bit to your Miami, because, you know, everybody knows Little Havana, but take me there.
Little Havana is this wonderful place full of tiny buildings with nice little porches and lots of actually Mexican restaurants and Central American restaurants.
I was not expecting that.
Yeah. The Little Havana used to be the place where Cuban immigrants came and they moved there. And that was in the 1960s. It's evolved since then over the last probably few decades. Now it's full of Central American fritanga restaurants like this one where Magda Molina is the manager. She's from Colombia, and this is where her employees are from.
Hay de todo. Hay nicaragüenses, hay salvadoreños, hay cubanos, hondureños, pues yo colombiana. Y pues aquí ha pasado gente de todas partes.
People from Nicaragua, from El Salvador, Cubans, Hondurans, and then she says, I'm Colombian. So what is it that attracts these Latin American immigrants to Miami?
Well, I think it's probably that Miami has always been sort of a hub for Latinos ever since people from Cuba started immigrating there in the 1950s and 60s. And they kind of built this very strong Latin culture in Miami. And it's known as a place where Latinos can move to and make a life.
Now, this dynamic of multi-Latino presence in a city is leading to some really interesting political stuff going on.
Right. So there have been some changes since Cuban immigrants started coming here decades ago. And those changes are reflected in these protesters that were at Senator Marco Rubio's presidential campaign announcement. Rubio made a point of announcing his candidacy at the Freedom Tower in Miami, which is the place where Cuban refugees in the 60s went to get asylum. And Rubio's parents came from Cuba, So some people, some of these protesters, feel that he should be doing more for immigrants today.
So they're actually calling him on it in a very public way. I wonder if this kind of protest would have existed in Miami, you know, 20 years ago.
Don't know that it would have. I mean, the political climate has definitely shifted and the demographics of Miami have shifted. I think there has always been a little bit of contention among Latinos, though, because of this thing called wet foot, dry foot, sort of the street name for the Cuban Adjustment Act provision that allows people from Cuba to have permanent residence within a year as long as they reach U.S. shores. Some people feel Cubans don't deserve such an easy path to residence. These are some comments on the Facebook page of El Nuevo Herald, the Spanish language edition of the Miami Herald.
Deport them once and for all. They need to have visas now. South Florida is going bankrupt. They're sucking up joint welfare that comes under tax.
It's people reacting to a story about 12 Cuban migrants washing ashore in Miami Beach.
If there's an embassy now, why do they come on rafts? Could it be they can't buy plane tickets, get visas? Or do they want to stay the darlings of what?
So what are diplomatic relations for?
Maria Elvira Salazar is a Cuban-American journalist on Mira TV, which is a regional Spanish language network.
They are right, and they should be very resentful. What they may not understand is that the Cubans were able to acquire that immigration status because they don't have a fatherland. It's the only country in Latin America where you cannot go home for Christmas or for New Year's.
But other Latin American immigrants say they can't go home either. Just ask Henry Castillo.
No, en teoría no puedo regresar a mi país.
Henry is a Venezuelan seeking political asylum. He moved here 3 months ago with his wife and daughter. He's here on a tourist visa, staying with friends and living off savings.
Bueno, yo soy periodista en Venezuela. En el mes de junio sufrí un atentado contra mi vida por no entregar unas grabaciones que yo había hecho.
Henry says he was a journalist in Venezuela. And he refused to turn in some tapes he had, so someone tried to kill him. If he got asylum here, he couldn't go back home.
Mira, créeme que incluso yéndome atemorizado, el día que decidí que tomé la decisión de irme, ya estaba montado en el avión, ese día sentí que me están arrancando un pedazo de mí.
He says when he got on the plane to Miami, it was like ripping off a piece of himself.
Nos tocó sufrir lo que sufrieron los cubanos hace 40 años, 50 años atrás, lo estamos viviendo nosotros ahora.
Henry compares Venezuela's political situation with what happened in Cuba more than a half century ago.
Sería de gran ayuda, de verdad, que el Estado de Estados Unidos nos diera esa aprobación también de la ley de pies mojados.
He says it would be a great help if the U.S. gave Venezuelans wet foot, dry foot. Maria Elvira Salazar, the Cuban TV presenter, says she can see Henry's point.
The Venezuelans are the Cubans of the 2000. Now, the big question is, will the United States treat them the same as the Cubans? I don't think so. I think that was just in a lifetime what the Cubans received.
And that's the dilemma. Some people say, well, why do only the Cubans get this special privilege? Why does it have to be a once-in-a-lifetime thing, since there are crises in other countries?
You hear this, and it's true. I mean, there is crisis after crisis in Latin America. So why does one country get the benefit when there is, you know, a series of crises everywhere else?
That's right. And I think there are probably two big sort of points that you can pick out. The Cuban people have been consistently under a communist regime for half a century. And people who support the wet foot, dry foot policy say that hasn't happened anywhere else in Latin America. And it's not like Cubans can go back to their home country. So they don't have that. So they need this protection. And another thing is the historical aspect of it, where in the time of the Bay of Pigs and in the 60s, when everything was going on with the Castro Revolution, there was just sort of a mix of political ingredients that led to the Cuban Adjustment Act being passed. The U.S. government isn't involved with anybody in that way right now. So that's kind of why that was cooked back then.
Maria Muriel is a local reporter based at WLRN in Miami, and we're so happy that you reported this piece for us. Thanks a whole lot, Maria.
Thank you.
Miami,
Now, besides a complicated relationship with the U.S., Cubans are known for many things, including, of course, cigars. When President Obama announced his plans to end the embargo against Cuba last December, it surprised many, including one group that actually benefited from the embargo, cigar makers in the Dominican Republic. Cuba was known for making the very best cigars, so when the embargo began in 1962, Dominican cigar makers lost a major competitor, and the DR went on to become the top cigar exporter in the world. But now, ending the embargo could fire up a smoldering turf war between both countries. Katie Manning tells us more.
In the year 2000, Cuban leader Fidel Castro insulted Dominican tobacco during a meeting of Latin American leaders.
El café de ustedes es muy bueno.
Sí, claro.
El tabaco no tan bueno.
Es mejor que de ustedes.
You have good coffee, Castro told Hipólita Mejía, who was the Dominican president then. Your tobacco, not so good. It's better than yours, Mejía fired back. That's why we make double what you do. We've already taken the international market. So began the most public tiff in the long-running cigar skirmish between the two nations. While Cuba claims to be top quality, the DR has top sales, and it helps that Dominicans know how to work it. Here in the capital of Santo Domingo, a stocky man named Leon Contreras manages a shop called Leyenda de Cigarros, or Cigar Legend. He stations an employee rolling fresh cigars in the front window to lure in tourists. Frame black and white photos of cigar-smoking celebrities like Julie Andrews and John Wayne stare down at the dark interior. Cuban cigars line the left side of the store. Dominicans take the right. A cash register divides the turf. Leon offers each customer a free Dominican house-made cigar.
Que si piden una explicación el por qué los puros cubanos dicen que son los mejores que los dominicanos.
Leon's customers often ask him to explain why Cuba has better cigars, but he tells them they don't.
Casi siempre los norteamericanos principalmente buscan puro cubano. Pero cuando le mostramos la calidad del puro nuestro.
People from the U.S. come for Cubans, he says. But when we show them the quality of our cigars, they realize that Dominicans are superior.
El puro cubano se le pica mucho.
Leon says he has to force himself to even inhale a little bit of smoke from a Cuban cigar. Despite his distaste, Leon does stock Cuban cigars in his store. 800 miles west of Santo Domingo, in Havana, the Cubans don't return the favor. A store with tall stained glass windows sells pricey pocket watches and only Cuban cigars. Jose Guerra rests on a stool behind a bar and tells tourists why there aren't any Dominican cigars. Cubans are the best, he says. Why would we sell a product that isn't going to satisfy our customers? Jose says he doesn't even see Dominicans as competition.
Ellos tienen su habano en el su tabaco, mejor dicho, no habano, el habano es nuestro.
They're in the U.S. market, he says, the biggest in the world. We're not. Let's see what happens when that changes. If the embargo does end, one of the places where Dominican and Cuban cigars will face off is in Paul Garmirian's Virginia cigar shop. Paul cuts a cigar and lights it up.
There's one thing that drives me insane is when people call it a stick. I want to buy five sticks. I mean, a ruler is a stick, not a cigar. It's a living thing. Have respect for it.
Tobacco has been Paul's life since he was 10 years old back in Lebanon, sneaking off to smell his dad's cigar box. He says competition from Cuba made Dominican cigars step up their game.
But I don't think it's an aggressive competition. It's a friendly competition. It's like two moms from different teams. They are friends. Their kids are playing. And each mom is yelling for her team.
Paul goes into a humidor, a room with controlled humidity that keeps cigars fresh, in the back of his shop. He pulls out a faded box of Cubans.
This is a box of cigars that was made in 1929.
He smokes one, and only one, every New Year's Eve. But even though the reputation is still strong, Paul says Cuban cigars aren't what they used to be. He says on the one hand, Cuba has the best soil, but there's no financial incentive for Cuban workers to make the best possible cigars they can. Premiums, made of specialty leaves and hand-rolled, because they're government employees. Cuban rollers make about $20 a month, no matter what quality of cigars they produce.
I mean, it's a system that is based on state control of production. Now, if you look at the incentive of the regular roller, they have a very limited income. When it's state control versus individually controlled, the result is not going to be the same.
Granted, this is coming from a U.S. businessman who sells Dominican cigars in his store, but the Dominicans have made similar observations, and they're using that to their own advantage. Unlike Cuban cigar makers, their Dominican counterparts can pay their workers more to make premium cigars. Here at a Dominican cigar factory called Matilde, workers make bonuses based on the number of premium cigars they roll.
Quizá temiéndole al monstruo que lo es Cuba, todavía es un mito fuertemente establecido.
The owner Jose Cejas says quality is his only weapon against the monster that's the Cuban cigar industry. His premium cigars cost about $20. The country's cheapest cigars are only about $2, but most Dominicans can't even afford those. Cigars are a luxury usually reserved for tourists. Still, many livelihoods in both the DR and Cuba come from cigars. And here's where the different economic systems in the two countries come into play, with their own advantages and disadvantages. In socialist Cuba, there might be lower pay, but the government employs tobacco workers, which means more job security. In the free market DR, workers earn more, but they're also more vulnerable to losing their jobs if the industry slows. In the tobacco fields north of Santo Domingo, Roselio Cruz plucks leaves from his acre of land. Deep wrinkles run across his face. Roselio's 51, and he's been working 14-hour days under the Dominican sun most of his life. He says that he doesn't have the option of finding a new job if demand for Dominican tobacco decreases. He's too old to be hired elsewhere. That's why Dominican factory owner Jose Cejas says there's so much at stake here.
Hay un orgullo sobre eso que cada cual guarda en su corazón.
We hold our cigar pride close to our hearts, he says, and we'll fight for our little piece of light and sun in the market. Whether or not Dominican cigars will have to duke it out against Cuban cigars on U.S. store shelves is ultimately up to Congress. Both countries have agreed to reestablish embassies in each other's capitals, but only Congress has the power to end the trade embargo, and that hasn't come up for a vote yet. So for now, the gloves stay on.
That was Katie Manning reporting. When the news broke out about the embargo ending, there were a lot of people making jokes about cigars on social media. But I bet a lot of people didn't realize how much these changes could actually affect the Dominican Republic. Thanks for that story, Katie. And coming up on Latino USA, I talked to two people who are having a great time sharing turf. But first,
it's a lot of people. It would be hard for the government to do it right. But right now, the government's not doing it all. And that's worse.
No te vayas.
Pensando siempre con algo mejor, toda la vida rebuscando, esa fue mi profesión. Desde que llegamos aquí, mira, en el 92, Miami fue mi centro donde he crecido yo. Hoy le canto a esta tierra, su mujer es su palmera, no hay frontera. Y caminando por la playa de mi bella ciudad, dándole la gracia por la oportunidad. Esta rumba pega donde sea.
Hey, if you enjoy Latino USA, I bet you will love NPR's Planet Money. It's full of funny, insightful stories about how the world works, like how Price Club and its imitators made shopping harder and why customers actually loved it. Plus, useful stuff like the inside story behind the resurrection of the Hydrox cookie. Find Planet Money now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the belief that investing in women and children today ensures a healthy, prosperous future for everyone. More information is available at gatesfoundation.org. And the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting Wikipedia and the Digital Public Library of America through its Universal Access of Knowledge program, working to facilitate the openness and accessibility of all knowledge at sloan.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. In Mexico, drug gangs and cartels are forcing hundreds of thousands of people from their homes and into almost unimaginable lives.
Yeah, imagine everyone in a city the size of Philadelphia fleeing the lives they've built, sometimes with just the clothes on their back. You get the scope of the problem.
So this is Linda Lopez. She's joining me in the studio. She's a journalist with WCBS 880 here in New York. Hey, Linda.
Hey.
Good to see you.
Good to see you, Maria.
You recently went down to Mexico to meet some of these people. And when I first heard about this, what was interesting was that as much as these people are fleeing violence in Mexico, they're not leaving Mexico.
Right. So human rights advocates call those people internally displaced persons, or IDPs. But essentially what they are refugees in their own country. They just haven't crossed a border. They're people who have every reason to pick up and leave and try to start over again, someplace like the United States. But many, like the people I met, are staying home in their own country.
You know, as somebody who's Mexican, it was really hard to hear what they've been going through. And they told this to you, right? They opened up and shared their stories with you.
Yes. Like one I spoke to, Doña Esperanza, she had lived her entire life in Sinaloa until 3 years ago. She says that's when the drug gangs came into her town, tried to take over the land for their growing operations, and threatened to kill anyone who resisted. One night, after members of one family were murdered, she says, 80 families fled, leaving homes, jobs, friends, possessions. They were terrified to return. We lost our houses, Esperanza says, and fled with nothing. They thought the move would be temporary, that they could ask the government for help to pay for rent and food. But the day I met her, Esperanza was sitting in the cramped office of a human rights group in Mexico City, 800 miles from home. Because of the danger, she wouldn't even give me her last name. And she says they received no help.
Nada, 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 nada.
Esperanza's story might be unimaginable to us here in the U.S., but it's all too common there, where people flee the violence of cartels and criminal gangs and become something like refugees in their own country.
Right. And so the question, of course, that many people have is, well, why aren't they coming to the United States?
That is the other reality. Mexicans determined to stay in Mexico, despite the dangers. Some in the U.S. might think Mexico's internal refugees are all trying to leave and head north.
That's not the case for the vast majority.
Sarnata Reynolds is a senior human rights advisor for Refugees International.
Even though we don't know exactly how many people are internally displaced, there are studies that put the number well over 1 million. I mean, it's a lot of people.
These are people who essentially decide to stay even after they've suffered so much and are pretty much invisible to their own government.
People who find themselves uprooted and away from everyone and everything they've known.
Maricela Orozco Montoya.
Maricela and her husband owned a small trucking company in Veracruz, where the whole family worked. The couple fled to Mexico City after their 19-year-old son was kidnapped and their 15-year-old son was killed, trying to get his brother back.
Los asesinan. Las mismas personas que secuestraron a...
They killed him, her husband says, the same people who kidnapped our other son.
Perdón, pero...
I'm sorry, he says. It's still tough for him. They can't go home to Veracruz. They fear for their lives after getting threats. Instead, they eke out a living in Mexico City, making food and selling it in the complex where they live.
So what kind of a future do they have? What are these people going
to
do?
The amazing thing is they say they have no plans to leave. How do I explain it, Marisela says. We don't care where we live, one place or another. We just want to find our son.
Hola, niños.
Hola.
While some families seek the relative safety of Mexico City, others go farther. Paula and dozens of members of her family fled Chihuahua together after falling victim to a criminal group. We were known as a business family, Paula says. 5 years ago, after one cousin was kidnapped and another killed, Paula and her family took the cases to the authorities and the state's Human Rights Commission. But that only made things worse. Her family was threatened. Then her uncle and three of his workers were killed. His ranch burned. His teenage son and daughter tear up as Paula tells the story. Now the whole family is living in Aguascalientes, 600 miles from home.
And so why did they move so far?
You know, it's a place that she describes as quiet, even boring. But that's why they're there.
Analizamos los estados.
I researched the safest places to go, she says. We all left and came here.
People have no idea how bad it is.
Sarnata Reynolds of Refugees International says Paula's family is relatively lucky. They're someplace safe. She says she's seen other displaced people living in horrible conditions.
Living on dumps, no clean water, no access to health care, and children not going to school because they didn't have identification.
But Sarnata says the Mexican government doesn't even acknowledge the problem.
If the government of Mexico was to recognize this and actually treat the victims of forced displacement in the country, it would be overwhelming. It's a lot of people. It would be hard for the government to do it right. But right now, the government's not doing it all. And that's worse.
Why is that? What is the government saying? And why isn't it doing anything?
Well, I asked. And in an email, the Mexican embassy to the U.S. says, quote, "It is challenging and complex to isolate internal displacement from other types of migration in Mexico," end quote. That's because Mexico is naturally a country of migration. Often, workers follow the harvest to another state and then come back home. The embassy basically says that the government is analyzing the situation. But that's not enough for advocates like Refugees International.
First, we want the government to admit this is happening and count people.
And then, Sarnata says, those people are entitled to a humanitarian response from the government. That means housing, healthcare, education, and security. All the things required to start over again in a new place. Meanwhile, Doña Esperanza from Sinaloa isn't waiting. She's doing a lot of those things on her own. She's taken a census on her own of more than 500 families that were displaced from her community. Got everyone's name, age, occupation before displacement, number of children, and a list of what they need. She's still fighting for that. What she really wants, the best thing, she says, would be for everyone to be able to go home and to live safely enough to never have to leave.
So do they think that's possible?
Pues, algún día.
One day, she says.
What about you, Linda? Do you think it's possible?
You know, it's tough to say. There's a sense of not really having security anywhere you are. What was so striking to me and really beautiful to me was that people in Mexico are like people anywhere else. They want to stay home. They love their own country. They want to be in their own country. Paula, at the end of our story, said to me, she was like, it's a great country, right? She's like, not so much the government, but the country. And she just meant from the sense of she couldn't find the security that she needed to find where she wanted to find it, which was home.
Thank you so much, Linda, for telling this story. I mean, great reporting. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
That was Linda Lopez, a journalist with WCBS 880 Radio in New York City. Today we're talking about turf wars. And while some of today's stories have some real serious implications, we wanted to end with something a little bit more hopeful. Now, language can be considered a turf, in a way, when immigrants from around the world are told, "This is America, learn English." It certainly makes language feel divisive. But for many Latinos who grow up bilingual, language isn't an either-or. It's actually both. And a new podcast from ESPN is embracing that reality. One Nación is a show hosted by SportsCenter anchor Max Pretos and ESPN reporter Marley Rivera. The show seemingly integrates English and Spanish, actually without drawing attention to itself.
To over 26% of Major League Baseball are born outside the U.S., and the majority of those players are Hispanic. Esos son hispanos, así que imagínate. Entonces, es natural que empecemos nuestro primer programa hablando de Major League Baseball and how language, how often it's a barrier for so many players. If we talk about
One Nación grew out of the same bilingual sports blog and video series of the same name. The point of the show is to do what any sports show does, which is talk about sports, but to do it so it feels natural for bilingual listeners who might talk about sports with their friends in the same way, in both English and in Spanish. So to talk about how One Nación goes about being inclusive and avoids a turf war, I'm joined by ESPN's Max Pretos and Antonieta Collins. Welcome to Latino USA, you guys.
No,
we're on the air now, correct? We're rocking.
So I wanted to tell you that, and people who listen to Latino USA know this, I know a lot about a lot of things. I know nothing. I know nothing.
I'll never admit it.
Nothing about sports.
All right.
I mean, it was so bad that, like, in the year 2000, I asked my office mate at CNN, I was like, "What's a Subway Series?"
It's a sandwichito.
Es un sandwich.
Dame dos Subway Series, por favor.
Una para aquí, una para llevar.
Sí.
¿Sabes lo que me encanta? Es de que tan inmediatamente empezamos a hablar español. I mean, I love the fact that it was like, within 1 minute of talking to you guys, we already jumped into Spanish, which is, of course, what One Nación, your podcast, and the whole movement at ESPN is all about, right?
Yeah. For me, it's good because I've been out of practice a bit with my Spanish, so to have these people around me where we can do that and have fun, it's very natural. I always like to compare it. Remember the old show, ¿Qué Pasa USA?
Mm-hmm.
Where they had it just down pat, where you could watch and go, okay, I understood the whole show, even though they're both speaking it. But I think that is invaluable because that's how we communicate most of the time.
Let's talk about One Nación, because I actually love, and for people who are listening to our show, I think they'll be very interested to see how easily we're flowing back and forth entre el español y el inglés, like, without a problem. And so this concept of one nation, of One Nación, like, where did that come from?
Well, you know, it was funny because as Hispanics, as we continue to grow here in the United States, we try to, like, adapt to what's happening, right, through changes. And here at ESPN, we were seeing the changes. How do we get there? And I think as we continue to ESPN hire, like, more talent that's bilingual, that Max is you're a mixture of everything.
No, we have so many Cubanos on air. With Levitard, Dan Levitard,
mm-hmm.
George Sedano, Pedro Gomez. I felt very comfortable with all of that. So
Max,
I think it's a testament.
And Max, on your podcast, One Nación, you guys are not subtle at all. In fact, you start out by saying, "Dudes, this is a show about Latinos in sports, and we're going to talk about Latino stuff."
That is a show that, when something in Major League Baseball where the Latino players are vilified because of how their culture determines how they play baseball, and then the American set of rules, it doesn't brush well. That is where we go, okay, we're going to talk about it. We're going to be real about this.
Which is why I really like the kind of journalistic work on your podcast, One Nación, because you guys took on an issue that, of course, I hadn't really thought about. It was the World Series, and you were saying that a pitcher had to translate to another baseman because the, like, team won't pay for a translator. And this is, like, a pitcher in the World Series, and he's having, like, is he getting paid extra for that?
No.
But the point of the story is I really appreciated, like, the journalistic, you know, investigative work that you guys are pushing. It's like you do have an agenda here.
Yeah, and we were very fortunate to have Marley Rivera, who is in contact with these players, and she has access to them, and they trust her. They want to come here and play baseball. And they don't want to stop and talk about it because it's – I don't know what's going on within the clubhouses, but maybe the message they're getting is, like, put your head down, play baseball, make your money. But I think the work environment could be a lot better, and I don't think there's an issue within Major League Baseball paying for a translator. It just doesn't hit them on their radar. It's someone has to bring it up to them. And I think if we can help make it an easier workplace for them, we could be a champion for something that makes us feel a lot better. That's what we want to do.
So, Tony, tell me a little bit about the feedback that you're getting from fans. Because, again, for me, I love the going entre el español y el inglés. A mí sí. Me fascina because actually it makes my brain work harder, right? And then I realize, like, actually it's not that hard, which is really cool because that's what you want to pass on to your kids. Like, you can do this. It's easy. But tell me a little bit about what fans are saying about One Nación.
I've gotten positive feedback. Really, they feel proud that they're being represented in a top major network and that they're being noticed and that they're making those strides to representar a nuestra gente. And for me, it's so weird because I started my career in Spanish at Univision, and it was all Spanish, and now I'm English, and yo me trago a veces. Like, sometimes I want to say things and I look like I'm on cloud nine, and it's not that. It's like the words are not coming, and they're like, my producers are like, well, you speak the English, or what do you mean that you don't have the words? I'm like, the translation. So I don't know if other people can relate to that, because it's a little bit harder than it seems.
That's such a great
she
word.
She makes it
too.
Easy.
But that word.
She makes it real easy.
Me trabo a veces. I mean, that's such a Mexican thing, me trabo. It's like, how do you even explain that? But basically, it's like a dam suddenly goes up in your brain and you can't get to the other side. So let me ask you this, Max. You know, el español no es tu primer idioma. Entonces, what's it like for you? I like the fact that you're kind of showing, like, yeah, I don't speak perfect Spanish. ¿Y qué?
I fill in the gaps a lot, and I abuse Spanish. And I have horrible – I think my content in Spanish is good, but I struggle with the tenses to this day. Femenino, masculino, and I'm like – and people go, that's – well, you just called the king the queen. I'm like, oh, whatever. Let's just,
you know what I meant.
Look, and I just want to get the message across, but I keep I should stop and really practice it, get a tutor and get it, fine-tune it where it can get there. And that's going to happen at some point. But I feel confident that I can go anywhere and communicate with with every culture, and whether I'm in Mexico or Puerto Rico or Colombia, and speak with them. And that's huge. And being able to consume things in Spanish and hear it is not an issue. But I'm not afraid to say about the struggles. That's part of being Hispanic in the United States.
And you're relatable. There's not – I mean, people can relate to you, and, you know, that you represent, you know?
Right. It's the truth. It's the truth.
I get that.
Now, so having said all of that, one of the things that kind of freaks me out about sports is the kind of, like, my team, you know, and the kind of, like, not your team, my team. And so I have to be honest with you, Max. There were some times when I was listening to the podcast and you're like – if there's a Latino man, I'm rooting for that Latino. I'm supporting it. And I was like, it begins to sound, and I'm going to use this word, con mucho amor, but you get what I'm saying, almost like a little bit like rah-rah, our people.
Yeah.
And I was like,
no, it's not completely true, because if it's my team, which is the Indians, I will pull for them over, say they're playing a team with a lot of Latinos, but generally.
Let me ask you this question. And I was wondering, I was like, so is that in part because actually being a Latino player is still really a big challenge, and that there is anti-Latino stuff going on there that I don't know about?
I would – maybe subconsciously I'm thinking that. When I first got into baseball and I started looking at the guys that I enjoyed, the one guy who was the biggest star on – baseball, because I was a Cleveland Indians fan, was Omar Vizquel, who played shortstop, and he's from Venezuela. When he did that, I loved the way he played. And granted, I don't think that had anything to do with him being Venezuelan. He was just a great shortstop. He did things differently. But there were American players doing that as well, like Ozzie Smith. But when I saw him, I started digging in about Venezuelan players and just started admiring their challenges, how they got there. And because of that, and because of the challenge, I did see them. There was that rah-rah for them. And I always took pride when I lived in LA. I went to Dodger games when they had a proliferation of Latinos. I was like, I'm going to more of their games. They had Juan Uribe, Yasiel Puig, Adrian Gonzalez, and I'm like, all right, there's an association there that I feel comfortable with.
And you know what, Max? To add to that, I think to covering stories, getting to do these stories from these players, even following them from the minors, and knowing our people and the American dream, I it's a rah-rah and I cheer for them because you know the struggle, you know the sacrifices. The sacrifices, like even with the Carlos Correa of the Houston yep. Astros, family that low income, came from nothing, and to see how they pull together all the sacrifices, the parents, the family, and now to see him do so well, it's prideful. It's very, muy orgullosa de que, oye, sí se puede, puedes lograr tus sueños, sacrificio, y mira lograr los frutos, ¿no?
Yeah, we look at them as our own. We're proud of them, and they give us that. I mean, again, if my team, the Indians, made the World Series, if they're playing the Astros, not they would. If they played in the American League Championship Series, Carlos Correa, todo respeto, pero...
Oye, look who's there. Está super hot. Será latino, gringo. No importa, nosotros somos bilingual girls y con el papá. Oh,
yeah. Every week, we end our show with some words of wisdom or sabiduría. And Toni had these great thoughts to share about what her mother said to her about how to level the playing field.
You know what? I know I speak a lot about my mom, but she's really influenced my life. And she told me this when I started back, when I actually covered the border between Texas and Mexico. And she told me, mija, recuerda, tú nunca... It sounds horrible, but it was really good, I promise. Mija, tú nunca eres más que nadie, pero ojo, nunca eres menos que nadie. Escucha, aprende, pero escuchas todos los días... Aprende algo porque nunca, nunca dejes que la soberbia te destruya. Wherever I go, I've done English, Spanish, sports, news. I never try to think that I am better than anyone, but I am never less than anyone. Always listen, learn from your peers. As corny as it sounds, and it's so simple because every day you can learn something, they teach you something, and go back and you know, put your best foot forward and like be yourself. It's so tough to be yourself, but it's the best thing that you can do. So learning to do that, that's the best advice I can give someone.
That was Toni Collins and Max Bretos from ESPN. And One Nación, the podcast from ESPN, is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and wherever else you might listen to a podcast. And I gotta say, I bet through their show, I'm actually gonna learn a lot about sports. Ya veremos. Anyway, that's it for today. Latino USA is produced by Daisy Rosario, Lita Hartman, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Antonia Cerejido, Julia Alsop, and Sarah Barrett. Julia Hsu is our production assistant. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Janice Yamoka, Maggie Freeling, and Gabriela Sierra Alonso. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, I will see you on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and on my Instagram. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Me trabo a veces un buen título para una canción. Trabo a veces. Hi.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school. More information is available at wallacefoundation.org. And Heather Sturtega and Paul G. Haga, supporting Salzburg Global Seminar, which works to challenge current and future leaders to solve issues of global concern. Learn more at salzburgglobal.org. This is NPR.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA... A group of undocumented student activists attempt to cross the U.S.-Mexico border in their caps and gowns.
I'm like, Mom, I love you, and I'm really sorry. And I promise that if this doesn't work, I'll give up on the U.S., Mom. But you have to give me this last chance. And she's like, okay, all right.
The story of the Dream Nine, next time on Latino USA.